Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Happy Black Friday. I hope that you have not suffered any terrible injuries or wounds, or that you have not injured others in your quest for merchandise. Very, very happy to get to be here with you. We like having shows on those days where, you know, the world is off. Maybe you're not familiar with Catholic Answers because you're getting to listen today. Usually you're at work at this time, or you have other responsibilities during this time. If you're new to Catholic Answers, you can find out all about us at Catholic.com. And all we do is explain and defend the Catholic faith. That's it. And we're going to have some fun this hour because sometimes on Fridays, we do what we call the panel show. And we talk to the panel and we look at the news of the world and the news of the church from a Catholic perspective. And that's what we're going to do for a couple hours. So we get two very smart and really fun people to do that with us. First, the president of Catholic Answers, Chris Check. Hi, Chris Check.
Cy, thank you for having me.
Happy Black Friday.
I laughed when you said that.
I don't know if you're supposed to observe this as Black Friday as part of the octave of Thanksgiving.
I'm going to probably offend, as I typically do. Yeah. This is a day I do not pay attention to at all.
Black Friday?
I tried entirely to pretend it's not happening.
Well, when do you get to trample people? Like when do you get your trampling in?
Oh, yeah, I feel like I've done enough of that.
Okay.
In my life.
Our other guest for this hour is apologist, author, speaker extraordinaire, Joe Heschmeyer. Hi, Joe.
How you doing?
Happy Black Friday, Joe.
Yeah, I also don't really celebrate Black Friday. I get all of my stuff on Black Thursday. I'm just kidding. Have you heard this?
Wait, there's
call Thanksgiving Black Thursday? Oh, yeah, it's terrible. It's like, rather than being thankful, what if you were covetous?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do the opposite of Thanksgiving. I don't like any shopping on Thanksgiving because the workers. We used to have some sense in America. It's the day for everyone to be with their family. Let them go home. What do you all think about that?
I think we did have some sense in America. It was in the early part of the 19th century.
In the early part of the 19th
century? And before.
Well, we didn't have Thanksgiving then, though.
When did
you couldn't have holidays because there was no
telephones. I thought Thanksgiving was sometime in Massachusetts. You know?
Oh no, Thanksgiving is a post Civil War holiday.
No, it's the real Thanksgiving I'm speaking of.
Oh, the real where
Squanto taught the Pilgrims how to grow crops.
When the people who
Chris, I gotta say, I'm kind of surprised you're not one of those people who says the real Thanksgiving is down in Florida with the first Mass.
Oh,
there was a massive Thanksgiving before
St. Augustine.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right.
Well, there was the event, but the event is separate from the later efforts to bring the country together after the Civil War.
The institution of the holiday.
Yeah, right. And the myth of America, the great myth of America, a place of religious tolerance.
Myths are important.
Yes, that's right. I can't see Joe, by the way, but they're going to help me with that. Okay. So what we do, Joe Heschmeyer, in case you don't remember this, I know Chris will remember because he's done this many, many times. I think we've gotten to do it with you once. I tell you...
once or twice, Joe? Just once?
Have you done this more than
I've
once?
Done it twice.
You've done the panel show twice?
I remember, Joe.
Oh, well,
thanks,
I was...
Chris.
Yeah. I thought the... Okay, all right, Joe. You've done this twice, and I'm super happy that we... now you're on your...
It's the tryptophan.
Your third... Yeah, is that tryptophan thing? By the way, I think the tryptophan thing is a myth too. I think the reason you fall asleep is because you just gorged on food.
Can I say another myth?
Yeah.
Turkey tastes good. That's a myth.
Ooh.
I don't think anybody likes turkey. I think every single person is faking it. Although, I am a dark meat person.
Yes, of course.
Because
the breast is inedible because it tastes like sawdust.
What is it? It's the. What do you think, Joe?
I'm going to go a little further and say seasonal foods I'm skeptical of. Now, let me put it in two categories.
What does that even mean?
There are seasonal foods that are seasonal because they're only available that time of year. That's not really true of turkeys. Like turkeys live year round. So,
I thought the turkeys just ripened up in November.
And that's exactly.
I thought they started falling off the turkey trees in November.
They're like avocados, giant, juicy avocados.
Yeah.
I feel the same way about pumpkin spice, anything. Like, if it was good, it'd be available year-round. I'm skeptical of seasonal foods.
No, Darren disagrees with you, I think. How do you feel about pumpkin spice, Darren? No, he says no. I am a big pumpkin spice fan.
You mean like in your coffee?
In everything. Just everything. Make ice cream, salad, whatever.
I would really encourage listeners to send angry emails
about the pumpkin spice.
So first of all, I think putting anything in your coffee is probably at least a venial sin. But just to the whole thing of seasonal foods, Joe, you can't be serious. I mean, there are, if I understand you correctly, you're objecting to the how do I put this, manufactured seasonal foods.
Yes,
because
yes,
there
exactly.
are, because there are, you probably shouldn't be eating strawberries in February.
See, yeah, those are ones, and actually, this is where I'm going to pull up the snobby I lived in Italy card. You know, foods that you have to flash freeze to eat year-round, you've killed the flavor.
I would just like to say I'm sorry to all of our listeners in the Southern Hemisphere. Thousands of people listen across the Southern, and it's perfectly appropriate for them to eat strawberries in February.
Well, feasts are local. We've also subjected them to a lengthy discussion about the strictly American feast of Thanksgiving.
Wait a second.
We're the only ones that do Thanksgiving on Columbus Day.
Do the Australians not thank anyone? Chileans not thank anyone? If I was an Australian, I'd want to say thank you to someone for making me an Australian. If I lived in the Andes, I'd want to say thank you, Lord, for making me an Andean Chilean.
Pumpkins are a seasonal food.
Oh, he's just moving on from that.
Pumpkins are a seasonal food, and pumpkin pie is good.
Yeah, pumpkin pie is very good.
So a literally seasonal food where God made it seasonal.
Amen.
I'm fine with
God
that.
Made it
seasonal. Starbucks makes it seasonal. I'm skeptical.
Right, very good.
Have you ever thought you were getting pumpkin pie and you accidentally got sweet potato pie?
Oh, I have not. But
that's
I can
only an upsetting
imagine.
Moment.
That sounds like oatmeal moment. Raisin debacle escalated.
Do you know what people around the world call sweet potatoes? Potatoes. In America, we call them sweet potatoes.
What's the difference between a sweet potato and a yam?
Something to do with Popeye, but that's all I know. Other than that,
that was bad.
Darren thought that was funny. A yam, what a yam.
Not even
I don't
Joe
know.
Would have. Oh, now that
no,
you have explained
that was,
it.
That was beneath even me.
We have so much news to cover.
I don't know. Why don't we just keep going like this?
I know. It is fun getting to talk with the two of you. All right. So I hadn't thought about that. I said Black Friday, and it's probably like Black Friday perhaps is a purely American holiday. And I use the word holiday loosely, yes. The worship
holiday,
of material things.
Holiday, derived from holy day, we're now using for strictly commercial feasts.
Although I completely understand the impulses of Black Friday, I am not a person who could get himself up off the couch and go fight for that $11 laptop at Walmart. I want the $11 laptop at Walmart. I completely understand the impulse. My opposition is pure laziness.
I don't want the $11 laptop.
You guys have deeper, I feel like you have an anti-materialist, spiritual reason, and I don't. I would gladly pay $11 for the laptop, and I would probably even enjoy the fight, but I just can't get myself off the couch to do it.
I like that you have vices competing with other vices.
Is it my materialism or my violence that I'm enjoying? Hell, it's a combination. It's a special day.
But ultimately, sloth wins the day.
Yeah, but sloth. That could actually be a banner over my office chair. The sloth wins the day. That's the theme of almost every day of my life. I can't believe I'm saying this with the boss sitting right here. Can I have a raise?
Yes. I might add on the radio.
Yeah, right. All right. There's serious stuff to talk about, but I feel like I can't transition right into the serious stuff. So I'm going to go with the... I get to choose which order we do the stories in. I'm going to go with the elephant.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about the elephant?
I do.
Did you both read the Atlantic magazine article about the elephant?
I read some.
Can I say I didn't make my way through the whole thing?
Well, that's probably okay. Few people do make it through an Atlantic magazine article all the way to the end. But
from time to time, there's something good in the Atlantic.
Remember when they used to have that guy? He died in Iraq, I think. But he was a great editor for Atlantic magazine. I can't remember his name now. But he made it a great magazine. And then he died. And then it's just
I mean, the quality of the prose in the Atlantic is better than most magazines.
Yes, I think that's true. It's like absolutely. The New Yorker without the complete madness.
Right.
Okay, so now that I've categorized the Atlantic Monthly, one of the great publications in the history of America, by the way.
It's been around for a very long time.
Yeah, I think it might even
Since
have been
the
Civil
19th
War.
Century. Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so the elephant. Let me just describe the elephant story. By the way, I just want to say this as well before we get into this elephant has a more dramatic, exciting, and interesting biography than any of the three of us who will now discuss the elephant. But the question about this elephant that who is currently in, am I getting it right, the Bronx Zoo? Or is it the Central Park Zoo?
Yes.
The Bronx Zoo. Is that this elephant is the subject of a court case in which the question arises, is the elephant a person or not? Discuss.
So I want to flag that when we're talking about person here, there's a really unfortunate conflation of terms.
Yes.
And the Atlantic sort of points to this, that they say a person is something of a legal fiction. Under U.S. law, a corporation can be a person, so can a ship. And Justice Douglas, in 1972, in a dissenting opinion, argued that we should also allow nature to be a legal person.
Yeah.
He specified alpine meadows, rivers, lakes, estuaries.
You're both a theologian and a lawyer. So what does this – just explain to me why, for example, Walmart is a person under the law.
Yeah, so this is one of those things where I see people get this wrong all the time. Because, like 2010, everyone was saying, oh, the Supreme Court just declared corporations are people. And it's like, guys, literally 1 U.S.C. 1, the very first law, like the very first law in the code defines person and includes corporations. And the reason is really simple, that you want corporations to be able to act. So if Catholic Answers does something, we want it to be able to have the ability to do things like own property, where it isn't just all of us owning property together or Chris owning property on his own, that it needs to have a certain legal standing. So, I mean, for instance, Carl Keating founded Catholic Answers. He's able to pass the torch without a really complicated legal process of having to sell the building to Chris or something like that. So to allow kind of a continuous corporate presence that's distinct from any one of the people, that's why corporations exist. There's actually a little bit of form and matter thing going on there. The famous Ship of Theseus thought experiment.
Right.
That, if you replace every panel of the ship and then build another ship with it, which one's the original ship? Well, likewise, if every member of Catholic Answers were to, go join Catholic Questions or something down the block, Catholic Answers would remain with new employees as a distinct entity. And all of its assets and all of its liabilities would stay with it rather than with, Catholic Questions or any of the employees.
All right. So the question then becomes, I guess there's two questions that arise. Is this a good way to think about, to use the word person in American law? But secondly, what does this have to do with an elephant in the Bronx Zoo? But I was having so much fun, I forgot that I have to take a break. So I'm sorry, Chris.
Go.
We'll be right back.
The elephant will not forget what we were talking about.
You always go right to the elephant in the room, Joe. We'll be right back with more
nice.
Catholic Answers Live, Black Friday panel discussion edition right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
EWTN has its own official YouTube channel with tens of thousands of videos covering just about every conceivable topic of interest to Catholics. And best of all, it's free. Every day, EWTN adds new TV shows, live events, devotionals, homilies, and specials to its YouTube channel. Visit the EWTN YouTube channel today. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live panel show today, where we look at the world, the news in the world, the news of the church from a Catholic perspective with our president, Chris Check, and with apologist, writer, and speaker extraordinaire, also former practicing attorney, Joe Heschmeyer. We'll go back to that conversation. Right now we're talking about, is an elephant a person? Can an elephant be a person? That's actually something that a United States court is being asked to decide right now. Before I send you back there, at shop.catholic.com, we've got lots of Black Friday deals for you, and you don't even have to knock somebody over to get them. Just go to shop.catholic.com. It's all these magnificent special deals, and it's right up till midnight Hawaii time. Midnight Hawaii time, shop.catholic.com. Chris, I believe Joe explained to us the idea in U.S. law, and maybe this is not unique to U.S. law. I don't know.
Well, sure, Joe. It must have some origin in British law as well. I understand and I agree with, in fact, the way that you've described, for example, that a corporation has an existence independent of the staff, for example. Also, this means that corporations can be liable. And
yes.
so there are protections for the staff, or even for the executives or the trustees or something like that.
Right. So that we say
that's actually one of the really controversial parts about it, though, because right. You can have things like, you know, ExxonMobil spilling a bunch of oil, and then the individual executives and all the employees are legally off the hook. The company foots the bill. So if you want to, you know, take your golden parachute and get out of there when, you know, the going gets tough. Well, you can actually avoid a lot of liability that way.
But this does, in fact, make the modern world possible, because you couldn't engage in large corporate efforts where people pool their funds and pool their efforts
yes.
to do things like, I don't know, like whatever Elon Musk is up to right now. You know, I'm sure there's enormous liability that comes with shooting rockets off. I mean, there's got to be enormous liability with that. No one's going to say, well, I'll invest my $100 in SpaceX if part of that investment includes I have a personal liability if SpaceX takes out a Pacific island with one of these things.
And we're especially litigious now, so these protections are good.
Yeah,
but I mean, we're making a distinction here between how the legal system functions, and it seems to me in a sensible way here, and whether a thing has a moral claim.
The thing yes. being the animal, this elephant?
Well, an elephant, a piece of a valley, a piece of land.
Oh, I see. Yes,
a
right.
mountain. Because you mentioned that as well, Joe. You said that, mm-hmm, said that mm-hmm. you know, they're
yeah, Justice Douglas has a pretty famous or notorious claim about arguing nature should be a legal person.
Right.
Okay,
but we're talking about a moral claim.
If I could just back
yes,
up,
yes.
Why can't we just use a different word than person? Because and maybe this was not always the case, but I think it was always the case that humans have been struggling over what is a person. I mean, they come to the Americas and we struggle over, you know, is the local guy a person, or is the local guy not a person in the same way a Spaniard is? You know, we go to Africa, and is the African guy a person? And then you resolve those issues with great deal of effort, because there's money involved in getting the wrong answer. And now we're arguing over, is the unborn child a person?
Everything,
you know?
Everything is a person except an unborn child.
Yeah, right. Now everything in the world is so the elephant is a person, but the unborn child is. I don't want to live in that world. So why not use a different word for person when I'm talking about Walmart or Catholic Answers or a ship at sea?
Yeah, it's a good point. The plural makes it a little clearer that when we're talking about the legal person, the plural is persons. When we're talking about metaphysical, theological, moral person, and the plural is people.
Except if we're talking about the Trinity.
Yes, that's true, which is actually the original use of person in the sense that we're kind of talking about. Can I go on a really nerdy tangent? I'm going to.
You should.
Personare means to speak through. And so there's a belief that the word person actually comes from the Etruscan word for mask. And so in ancient Greek theater or Greco-Roman theater, you would speak through a mask and take on what we would now call a persona. That the actor would play a role. And so person originally didn't mean an individual nature of a rational substance or not rational subsistence. It meant like a role that you played. So using person for the Trinity it took a lot of redefinition of the term to make sure that we didn't fall into modalism. Modalism is the idea that God acts as the Father and as the Son and as the Holy Spirit, but he's not actually three separate persons.
Right.
He's just one person in three different roles. That is how, you know, someone 300 years before Boethius might have understood three persons. That's not at all, of course, what, or, you know, maybe 1,000 years before Boethius, that's not at all what we're trying to say with person. So person has for a very long time been a really controversial term.
Well, first of all, just so people know, the definition that you gave of person comes from the philosopher Boethius, who has never been topped as far as the definition of a person, which is an individual substance of a rational nature. Secondly, it always amuses me when you say, can I be nerdy for a minute? Like, what do you think you're doing all the other minutes, Joe? Like, that always amazes me. Oh, yeah, for a minute, I'm going to stop being cool, Joe, and be nerdy, Joe. All right.
Okay, so, that's a good point.
So,
yeah, you want to talk about Catholic theology for a second?
So the rationality, by its nature, confers on the person claims certain moral claims. Or,
exactly.
or rights.
But it has to be an individual substance.
I'm trying not to use that word if I can. But,
of a rational nature.
Yeah.
You know, so that means that the angels, for example, are not collectively a person. The angels are
individually
sure. a person because they're rational. And so we don't get our personhood from our ability to reason, but from our nature as individuals made to reason.
Yeah. So let's use this word because I don't have another one. But it's the word is rights, and we talk about animal rights a great deal.
Right.
But are there such a thing
as animal rights?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really tricky to say that there are such things. I know Trent Doherty, I think at Notre Dame, wrote a book from a Catholic perspective on what obligations do we owe to animals. And there seems to be some moral obligation not to, for instance, torture animals needlessly. And it's hard to explain why that's immoral without some sense of you're violating the dignity of the animal.
Sure.
Even if that dignity is limited not to being needlessly tortured.
Sure.
So in that limited sense, they're kind of rights holders.
And in the torturing of the animal, of course, the torturer is harming himself by his evil act, and so that's an important consideration.
But you have to be very careful about ascribing rights to animals, because the rights that each and every human being has at every stage of life, whatever the condition of that life, are related to the fact of the human being a good in itself, that is an end in itself, and that the animal never possesses that. So whatever rights the animal has, to me, I would say, my argument would be, Joe, they're related to the care of the creator in making the animal. That is, I don't have the right to treat in a cruel or unnecessarily negating way what the creator has taken such care to make beautiful and good and delightful. Is that for the animal's good? Yes, but primarily it has to do with the creator and not defacing it. It's like the Mona Lisa doesn't have any rights, but it would be such a grave insult to Western culture, which produced that work via the person of Leonardo, that you cannot deface that thing. You cannot treat it in a way that doesn't comport with what it is.
Right.
Yeah, if you filled in the Grand Canyon and made it a parking lot, the Grand Canyon obviously is not a rights holder, but it still stands to reason that something of the created order is being violated there.
Right.
And I actually think that's the easiest, like, in a way, we can sort of punt on the issue of what rights, if any, does a non-rational animal have by just saying we have an obligation to treat things in their proper order and respect them appropriately.
Yeah.
Because we are rational creatures.
So is this helpful, Joe and Cy, or not, in the conversation about rights? And again, for me, it's a complicated word, especially because So much of it is tied up in Enlightenment philosophy and the revolution that follows it. But is it part of the conversation to ask the question that if someone is going to make a claim or a person is going to make a claim to rights, he's doing it of his own accord. And so, for example, a valley can't make this claim or an elephant. But then the other is he has the capacity, at least potentially, to enforce them.
Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying.
I think the obvious danger there would be the unborn who can't, you know, file lawsuits themselves.
Correct, so potentially.
Yes, they do have the potency, right. But they don't have the standing as such yet.
Isn't that a critical part of this definition?
And we got to get to whether this a particular elephant is a person right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's a panel conversation for both hours, getting the Catholic perspective on the news of the day, whether that is the news of the world or the news of the Church in particular. And I didn't tease this before, and I should have said this. It has now become a tradition of these panel Friday panel shows that I play some wacky audio from National Public Radio. And I will be doing that later and getting your comment on a news report from National Public Radio. So I want you both to know.
I want to stress that we don't know what this is about.
No, this is it will come as a complete surprise to you. And maybe you will not find it wacky at all. Maybe you'll say, no, that's perfectly reasonable reporting from National Public Radio.
I think you should get combat pay for listening to National Public Radio.
Oh, man.
I was thinking he had too easy of a job finding them saying something weird on National Public
Radio. Well, that's the thing. I listen for about 5 minutes a month, and I find the strangest things. Well, it's not hard to find these things, but I have to say I get a little twinkle in my eye when I'm driving in the car and they start and I'm like, oh, this one's going to be for Joe and Chris. So I think I have a good one for you today.
Cy, I think you've solved the elephant problem with your observation in the previous segment, and it's this. Apart from the created order and the understanding that there is in fact a creator and that in his creation there are various orders of things, apart from that, we immediately descend into all kinds of philosophical and legal chaos. And that's exactly what's happening in the case of this elephant. Now, I think an interesting conversation might be to have with this lady who wrote the piece. What does the dignified and not cruel treatment of an elephant constitute? And I would be prepared to say that the little 1 acre space that that elephant is contained in without the company of other elephants probably constitutes some level of cruelty. But that's a different thing from saying that the animal of itself has rights in the way that a rational creature does.
I think the word dignity there probably is the right one rather than rights.
We
ought to respect the dignity of animals. We ought to respect the dignity even of creation itself.
And that dignity,
totally non-rational, totally non-sentient.
That dignity that we respect derives from, as Sai observed, the fact that this is something that God created.
Right, and created so beautifully. I mean,
for our use and not abuse.
When you think about everything else in the universe, and in almost every square inch of the universe, as far as we know it, an elephant far surpasses almost all of it. I mean, there are very few things that have the intricacy, the craftsmanship, so to speak, the beauty of an elephant. And you could say that about any animal walking around on this earth. But in particular, as you get into the higher animals,
I heard a blind guy say that an elephant was just like a rope.
I heard him say, all right. I just would like to point on to an irony. Do you guys know who said the following sentence, one of the greatest pro-life sentences ever uttered? A person's a person, no matter how small.
Yeah, Dr. Seuss.
No, that was Horton the elephant, who said that.
Good point.
So if elephants are pro-life, I say, yeah, give them all.
I like that you're giving not just personality to elephants, but literally fictional elephants.
You know,
fictional according to you.
Elephants are very famously part of Hannibal's Italian campaign. But the truth is he lost about half of them coming through the Alps, and then they featured in one battle in northern Italy, but most of that decade-long campaign up and down the Italian peninsula in the Second Punic War, he didn't have them.
What he did have was one of the greatest military minds in the history of the world.
He did, and he had a lot of resolve.
Yeah.
Yes.
A lot of Romans who had my philosophy at the time. Sloth wins the day.
Carthago,
Delinda
Est.
No. Okay,
well, they had patience.
I feel like Happy the Elephant. I want to be... Okay, I keep getting distracted, but Chris said the lady who wrote this article, and I think that's because Chris assumes that anyone who defends the personhood of an elephant would be a lady, but it was Brandon Keim who wrote the article. So
I thought it was Jill Lepore.
Oh, am I reading that?
I think it actually is a lady.
No, it is a lady.
Oh, no.
I'm looking at the article.
You know what? There are two elephant articles at the Atlantic, and we might be talking about two. The Atlantic is on a real elephant personhood campaign. So I didn't realize
this was right.
A whole campaign.
I apologize, Chris. In Lepore's article that I think really puts a bow on the earlier point you were making, that it's really problematic to refer to this legal standing as personhood, because she says a person is something of a legal fiction. Under U.S. law, a corporation can be a person. And four sentences later, she says, pro-life activists have argued that embryos and fetuses are persons. Yes. But that's, like, we're using person in a totally equivocal sense here.
Right.
Pro-lifers are not saying that an embryo is a person in the way that the Yurok tribe says the Klamath River is a person. We're saying a person is a person literally, that it is literally an individual who has a rational nature.
I think Jill and I can come to the same conclusions about this elephant, but mine or ours is from a, conduit of rationality, and hers is largely based on emotion.
That's right. The elephant is a sweet elephant that suffered a great deal.
Yes, and it was separated from its aunts and uncles and cousins.
and the science that she gives is that this elephant can recognize itself in a mirror, so clearly it has self-awareness, which, I mean, what a fascinating field, animal consciousness, for both philosophers and scientists. But the fact that the elephant recognizes itself in a mirror is not dispositive of whether or not this is the equivalent of a human being.
By the way,
to pretend that it is so silly.
It may be thinking it's seeing another elephant, by the way.
They have a test to distinguish that. They'll put something weird on the animal's forehead and see if it like tries to get it off. Now, this is a little bit biased against animals that have short appendages, but nevertheless, this is one of the ways they know they try to distinguish between an animal thinking it's seen another animal and an animal thinking that it's seen itself. But that takes both a recognition of the animal, a sense of self-awareness, and it takes a certain level of motor skills. So the danger of this test is that people have used it to argue that not only are the unborn not persons, but neither are born children up to 9 months, up to 2 years, right, because it often takes little babies a while to reliably pass this test. I recently, unrelated to this, tried this on my 3-month-old son.
No. To see, if he, not, to see no. if he was a person?
Don't do science on your baby, Joe.
This is the problem. Being married to a therapist, we hear of all sorts of crazy things researchers have done to kids. And it's you know, like the neutral face experiment, if anyone's ever heard of that, where you do a neutral expression.
And you just upset the child.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. We haven't done that one yet.
Can we bring Mrs. Heschmeyer out here to Southern California and do this test on some of the staff here at Catholic Answer?
Oh, yes, I think we should just start. Hopefully they're not listening to the show. We'll be able to ambush them better.
I do feel like Chris has led us to where we might fruitfully conclude this argument, and that is that we really don't want to be mean to elephants, but I feel like many Christians are resentful of the animal rights movement. And not just Christians, but many people who are pro-life people from all walks of life are resentful of the animal rights movement, not because they don't like animals, but because they like babies a lot. And they have a visceral reaction to that. This is hypocrisy, this love of animals, while you're killing babies in the womb. And I think we have to get over that emotion and let the animals have their due as well. There is something magnificent about the God's creatures.
Yeah, I think when you have a double standard, try to resolve it in the right direction.
Oh yeah, thank you, Joe.
You know, like the problem isn't that we're treating elephants too well; it's that we're treating humans too poorly.
Yeah.
So if you see this contradiction, this tension, don't make the elephant's life worse. That's not going to fix it.
I have to say though, I am also the same person who thinks, and I've argued with Trent Horn about this, like the whales at SeaWorld. They're fine. They're in a big, beautiful tank. They're happy whales. They get a lot of food. I love zoos. I love animal adventure parks. I think there are standards that you should have, but I think this modern, like, oh, the cow is so upset because there's a fence around the field. The cow does not care about the fence around the field.
I, you know, on the SeaWorld one with the killer whales,
I'll fight you on this. I will fight you.
Blackfish. Have you seen that documentary?
Yes.
I haven't seen it, but I understand.
It's the most pathetic. I'm sorry, but it's not even journalism.
Okay.
It's all about the feelings of the people who.
It's a little tendentious.
It's not a little tendentious. There is no contrary point of view offered, which is a basic law of journalism. Zero. And I'm sorry.
I want to point out how remarkable it is that we've kind of switched sides. Normally, as Chris says, Cy is like the resident hippie. And here he is saying we should be near to killer whales.
I don't want to be mean to killer whales. I'm just saying SeaWorld is not being mean to killer whales. They take beautiful care of these killer whales. I have gone and paid good money at resorts that don't have as nice a pool as these whales get. So I feel like maybe give the whale a cocktail every now and then and we'll call it a day.
I do miss the circus where they got in the pool with the whale and, you know, swam around with it, and that's what it was. It was a circus.
Yeah, but what? I'm not opposed to circuses either. But I guess I'm the resident grumpy conservative, and you two are the wild eyed animal rights liberals today. All right, let's take a break, and we'll come. I got more news I want to get to though, I hope everything goes well for the rest of the lifetime of Happy the Elephant. Right back after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Thank you.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Imagine like Caravaggio was gonna do a painting of David Anders. You're sitting there getting ready to do this painting, and he takes his time. You're sitting there, you're like really excited about how it's gonna look, and then turns it around and it looks like Tom Price. Like, how would you feel about that?
That's a big improvement.
Wow.
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders tonight, 11 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Our guests for this panel discussion program on this Friday afternoon are Chris Check, our president, and Joe Heschmeyer, the author of a lovely new book, a really fine new book, a needed addition to the Catholic Answers collection. It's called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, the Catholic Witness of the Fathers in Christianity's First Two Centuries. Congratulations on the book, Joe.
Thank you very much.
I hope it sells like a million copies.
So do
That'd
I.
Be great.
I know you. Yeah. Chris definitely hopes it sells a million copies.
I'd be okay with it too. Yeah, it'd be nice.
Well, I wish people would take that much of an interest, because I think a lot of people live their understanding of history is, look, the early days of Christianity are like just shrouded in darkness and mystery. You know, we kind of know that there was this rural preacher, Jesus. But other than that, you know, until about the time of Constantine, we don't know anything. It could not be farther from the truth. We know a real solid, clear history of the Catholic faith.
I think another important point here, Cy, is that we owe, speaking of things to be thankful for, we owe a real debt of gratitude to the fathers and even many people whose names we do not know, who worked out all of these Christological and Trinitarian questions in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries that when we say the creed, we just, you know,
I know,
totally take it for granted.
This is one of the most striking things about it. Like, this is one of the things about Protestantism that I have to admit I just don't understand psychologically and rationally, that if you don't think that the church is protected by the Holy Spirit and guided by the Holy Spirit and preserved from error by the Spirit,
right,
how in the world do you end up with trusting the three persons in one substance, and Christ having a fully divine and fully human nature with a human will and a divine will? And, you know, like, there are some really fine distinctions being made that are critical for making sense of the biblical evidence and not holding a heretical view of God or a heretical view of Christ and his humanity and making nonsense of the cross. Like, you veer one degree off in either direction, and you find yourself in hot water theologically very, very quickly. And so the idea that we just got all of this right by sheer human effort is like a shockingly Pelagian understanding of how theology works.
And I would have hoped that had I lived during this time, I would have had the good sense to just be quiet and listen to what the church was going to say when she worked it out. But, you know, I read these heresies and I'm like, oh, I could have been a Monophysite.
I often feel that way.
I could have been an historian. I could have been an Arian. Yeah. All these make perfect sense to me.
Like, if these people had not lived and died for the truth and allowed themselves to be docile to the Holy Spirit for century after century, I don't understand. Like, Arianism seems perfectly reasonable in a way where you go, oh yeah, that makes sense. I don't know how I'm with you, Chris. We just stand in such a privileged position because of the humility and docility of, you know, these saints.
And in fact, if I can underscore this, we sometimes will say, or you will hear people say, boy, if I had known Jesus or something like that, then I would have, you know, lived a better life. Well, of course, we have him here, really, truly present in the Blessed Sacrament. There's your segue. But in any case, we tend to think we're at some kind of a disadvantage given the time that we live in, theologically speaking. But all these things have been worked out for us.
Right. What's the thing that you say, Joe? You always say about what the apostles had and then what the apostles lacked and then what we have and what we lack. Do you have a little saying about that? Do you know the saying I'm talking about?
I may or may not know the saying. I know that Augustine talks about how the apostles saw Jesus and had to take the church on faith. They have this band of like a dozen people, and they have to trust it's going to become the largest religion in the world. I think he says this in his tractates on John. I don't remember exactly. But we see the church and have to take Christ on faith.
Right.
That we have to trust that the church is telling the truth where it came from. Now, historically, all the evidence points to that, but there still is an act of faith. You know, someone could say, yeah, I choose to believe everyone in the first century is making this up, and that's really implausible, but you couldn't, you know, demonstrate, like as with any historical proposition, you know, you can't prove that George Washington wasn't an elaborate hoax the founding fathers played on us to, you know, they pretended there was this guy.
Yeah.
So we still have to take Christ, even in his existence, on faith in one sense. And they had to take the church on faith in terms of it becoming the thing that he promised, that the mustard seed would become the mustard tree.
Right. But it's but that formulation of Augustine that I got from you, it does put into perspective that they didn't face any less difficulty with us because of their being at the beginning. We have so many advantages that they didn't have.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Like 99.0% of the people around them probably thought they were crazy. And so they had seen something miraculous. But you still have to trust that you're not just delusional because, you know, you and your friends have seen the risen Christ.
Right.
Yeah. It would be very easy to fall into the, well, everyone around me really goes this other direction.
Yeah.
And then much more so, the people who lived at that time didn't know Jesus personally, but just have to trust this small group of people who are just dead set that they definitely knew him, definitely saw him rise from the dead.
Chris gave me the segue with his invocation of the Eucharist because the U.S. bishops just met to talk about the Eucharist. Did either of you? So I'm moving on to another news story. That's what I'm doing right now.
I see what you're doing.
Either of you have any impressions that you are left with from that meeting in the bishops of the bishops here in the U.S. and its product?
I do. I'm worried mine might be cynical, so I'll let Chris go first.
Oh, you think he's going to be less cynical than you?
So this is the difficulty. The document of itself is a perfectly fine and useful document in reiterating the theology of the Eucharist. It came out of a need to give an answer, a clear answer to the faithful about worthiness, a phrase that it seems to me sort of came into more public use as a consequence of this Eucharistic coherence, and it doesn't address it. It addresses it in theory. It quotes the relevant canons 915 and 916 about manifest persistent, manifest grave evil. But what people were asking was, what about a politician who is specifically encouraging, facilitating, promoting the murder of the unborn through legislation? And it does not address that question. And as a consequence, it seems to me that nothing will change. Nothing will change in this regard.
Right. To put it into very concrete terms, like when I was a kid, the question was about Ted Kennedy. Well, what about Ted Kennedy? Now the question is Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi. So you just take the most prominent
Gavin
Catholic politicians, we're here in California, Gavin Newsom, and you ask this question, but it's not a
Mayor Lori Lightfoot, if you're in Chicago, even though she's not.
Well, no, here's the thing. So, yes, there are moral principles that Catholics need to follow, and that's great. But simply stating the principle is insufficient. If there are not sanctions, then the principles quickly lose their, if not their meaning, their practical application.
Well, at the risk of being kind of consequentialist, what will be the consequence of the actions, however? Like, it seems to me, and this is reading the tea leaves, I do know Archbishop Corleone personally, but not in any intimate way. But it seems to me, as an outsider, looking up there to what they're doing in the Archdiocese, Corleone seems to be moving step by step in some kind of process in which he is confronting Nancy Pelosi on her counter witness to the gospel, you know, praying for her, fasting for her, doing these things. So let's say I have no idea what the next steps in that, or if even there are next steps. I'm not trying to, you know, say that I have an insight. It just looks from the outside. Okay, so say he confronts Nancy Pelosi and publicly says, look, we've done all these things, X, 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 and Speaker Pelosi continues in her manifest grave public sin. She can't receive communion. What is the good that will come from
that? Two things will come of it that will be good. And I think he has, on this show, in fact, Sai, correct me if I'm wrong, said, yes, there is a process. So two things good will come of it. One, he will have done a great act of mercy to Nancy Pelosi that, please God, before she dies, shakes her conscience and brings her to repentance. Two, he will have clarified things for the faithful of his archdiocese and more broadly the way the media works today. So two good things at least will come of that.
And Joe, do you have an answer to my question?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think getting back to your very first question about the thoughts about the document, my thinking is anyone confused about Eucharistic coherence and all of that is probably not going to read a 31-page USCCB dossier on the Eucharist.
Really? You don't think so?
So, well, I mean, in all seriousness, it's this question of like, who is actually the audience for this text? And it feels like the product of a bureau. Like, it's fine. The document is fine in what it says, and then it doesn't say anything heretical. But I would be genuinely shocked if anyone's view of the Eucharist changes in a very meaningful sense on the particular issue of worthiness to receive.
Yeah.
On the basis of reading that. It just doesn't seem like it's likely to happen.
In that way, it might be reminiscent of the 1990s documents on child abuse in the church, child sexual abuse in the church. Great, fantastic documents. Did absolutely nothing to advance the cause of protecting children.
Well, I almost worry it's more like the Atlantic fishing documents the USCCB puts out, where you're just like, someone spent a lot of time writing the document no one is going to read.
Right.
I didn't even know they were doing fishing.
That may be an exaggeration, but there's this, like, the USCCB has this tendency to put out documents on every issue.
Well, that was my argument when I was covering the Catholic Church here in California. The Catholic bishops, I think back in the early 2000s, a document on kindergarten and what should be provided in public school kindergarten and who it should be provided to. That is such, to me, as a bishop, I would say, no, we can't say anything about this because all this does is dilute anything we ever say about anything else. We don't know any more about kindergarten than anybody else. Let's not. But they never say let's not. We're the wordiest church in the world.
I have a few questions that if I were given 10 minutes with the USCCB, and this will never happen, but maybe one of them is listening right now. But I have a few questions. One is, there was a time, actually, there have been multiple examples in the history of the church where churchmen, bishops and popes, for example, I think of Gregory the VII, right, and the Holy Roman Emperor, and the trip to Canossa, for example.
Yeah, Frederick.
But even more modern examples, the Feast of Christ the King, which we just celebrated, instituted by Pius the XI as a consequence of the secular government's abuse of the church in Spain, Mexico, and Russia, where there have been clear examples of prelates standing up to the secular authorities whose behavior is gravely immoral. And where is that? What is going to be necessary for a kind of a recapturing of that spirit? That'd be one question. I've got more.
Okay, well, we can do those when we come back. I want to say again that we'll do our audio from National Public Radio, our wild and wacky audio, which I have to say, not very hard to find. I listened for one day, came up with something good. So we'll play that audio, we'll get your reaction to that, and we'll continue with the news of the day from a Catholic perspective. I'll leave it in your hands, Joe and Chris, when we come back. If you want to continue, it does seem like we've made some relatively dismissive points about the bishop's document on the Eucharist, but if there's more you want to dig into, we can do that. If not, I'll play you the audio, and we will. And we got a whole bunch more stories from around the world, from the news of the church, from the news of the secular world, to take a look at from a Catholic perspective with our president, Chris Check, and with apologist Joe Heschmeyer. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.